Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm delighted to welcome to the show writer and podcaster Elizabeth Day. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Good, thanks. It feels unfair. I kind of threw writer in there as if it was a throwaway, which is not fair because you're a really successful novelist. But I suppose your podcast, How to Fail, has become just a kind of a phenomenon, really. You do live theatre shows now, and I know from friends that they are like a tribal gathering. I think you're almost a cult at this stage. So tell me first how the podcast came about. Where were you at in your life? I think it was at the end of your 30s that you decided you wanted to examine failure.
I was absolutely at the end of my 30s and in many ways at the end of my rope.
Okay.
I had had a decade of immense transition where I had got married to the wrong person and then I got divorced. I had tried and failed to have a baby. I did lots of unsuccessful fertility treatment and had the first of three recurrent miscarriages. And then post-divorce, I got into a new relationship with, you know, very different hopes. And I felt like I'd done the growing and I'd done the work and that this one was really going to last. And that one ended out of the blue just before I turned 39. And I felt like such a failure in that moment. And you're kind enough to mention the fact that I also write books. And I'd had some novels out and I was a staff feature writer on a Sunday paper. And so professionally speaking, it looked like it was going according to plan. But personally speaking, I felt like a total failure. And I wanted to know how to get through it. And I wanted to know how other people survived it. And I started listening to podcasts at that time, actually, because I was feeling so heartbroken that I couldn't listen to music because it seemed to bear specific resonance to my grief.
Every song. So,
exactly. Every single song that came on. And so I started listening to podcasts and it made me realize that podcasting back then, it was still relatively in its infancy, but that it was this space where you could have these really intimate conversations. And so that's where the idea came from for How to Fail.
Yeah. I think you put your passion for connecting down to your childhood in Derry, do you?
Yes, definitely partly because, as you can hear, I've got an English accent and my dad was, he's retired now, but he was a surgeon and he happened to get a job in Atna Gelvin Hospital in Derry. And we moved out there when I was four and there was a slight family connection. My grandmother had been born and raised in Belfast and I never picked up the accent for whatever reason. I only ever had the slightest lilt. And it made me feel like an outsider because that's how in many spaces I was treated, totally understandably. If you'd only just met me that given day, you'd think I was either part of the military or on holiday. It was quite curious for an English child to be there at that time.
Yes.
And I think what that did, it gave me sort of two insights. One was that being an outsider, whilst it can be difficult when you go to secondary school and teenagers are looking for points of difference, it also is a position of privilege because you can observe what's going on. And I spoke a lot less than I do now because I hated my accent and I hated my voice. And when you speak less, you listen more.
Okay. And on a side note, you tried your damnedest to fit in. You even went Irish dancing, you poor thing. Did you have the did you have the rig outs and the ringlets and all that kind of thing?
Oh my gosh. I actually never had the proper uniform and I never did my hair in ringlets. My hair was, it is just still quite disobedient, my hair. It will never do what you tell it to. But I did, I went to Irish dancing lessons with my sister and actually they were so fun. And I think because you don't use your arms, it was kind of easier for me to pick up as a slightly uncoordinated child than say salsa dancing or something. And I absolutely loved it. And I think I was quite good at it. And I can still remember a few steps.
Elizabeth,
Brendan,
if you weren't that good, no. If you never got the rig outs and the ringlets, you
True.
Obviously didn't make it to fesh level.
I didn't. No,
you weren't at the top level of competition there. But anyway, look, you're probably a better Irish dancer than most people you know anyway, are you?
Listen, it's one of my, well, most people I know I am probably better, but that's not saying much. But it's clearly one of my failures.
Okay, so Talk to me a bit about failure and why it's important. And you've talked to a lot of people about failure as well. Tell me about the people who've dealt with it best. What's the best way to handle failure?
I've learned so much about failure from the guests I have on my podcast. The format is I ask a guest to come in and to give me three failures, three things that they think of as failure from their life. And failure actually is the one thing that connects us all. Even if you try to avoid it, I can guarantee that you will fail at some point in your life.
Yeah. And look, it's probably good to talk about it because I suppose the alternative is shame, isn't it?
Yes. And yeah. I'm a huge believer, as Brené Brown says, and she's a former guest on How to Fail. It's one of my favourite episodes. She says the antidote to shame is sharing, because yeah. shame thrives in silence, because shame relies on us feeling that we are uniquely fraudulent and uniquely awful
yes.
and unique failures. And actually, when you take the courage, when you take the risk and have the courage to open up about something that you feel shame over, my experience of it is that that is the point of true deep connection.
Really?
That actually
okay.
the thing that you consider the most personal failing will turn out to have the most universal resonance in ways you can never imagine.
I'm not sure I'm going to try that one out. I think if I told people the truth, they'd be too horrified, but okay, I'll trust you on it.
Now I'm immediately intrigued, Brendan.
Do men tend to have a different attitude to talking about failure to women? I'm just saying, are men a bit more reluctant to admit failure or talk about it, do you think?
Yes, I definitely found that when I first started How to Fail. So when I first started the podcast back in 2018, I was really reliant on, you know, friends and contacts from my years in journalism to agree to being the guests. And all of the men that I approached said to me, I don't think I have failed. So I'm not sure that I'm right for this podcast. And all of the women that I approached, apart from one, said to me, oh, I failed so many times. I can't whittle it down to just three. And it was so interesting because actually when I interviewed those men, and this has changed massively over time,
yeah.
when I interviewed those men, they had failed. They just hadn't labelled it that.
Okay. So listen, part of the reason you alluded to this earlier, that I think people are sometimes so open with you, is that you've been very open about your own struggles as well. And I suppose particularly yeah. around your fertility. And I know that you talking about that has been really helpful to a lot of women. So can we just talk about it a little bit? Do you mind?
Of course. Thank you so much for being so sensitive and asking.
Okay.
Of course, I don't mind at all.
Okay. So look, can you explain first? Because I do think as a man, I mightn't fully understand this. And I also think that for people who had kids easily and take it for granted, I think they may not fully understand it or ever have thought about it. Can you explain how all-consuming the desire to have a child was for you?
Yes, I can. I've actually never been asked to explain this before. I think, you know, I wasn't someone who, as a child, dreamt of wedding days and motherhood. I just thought that it would happen. And I never thought to question that. I felt that it was almost guaranteed. And there was a lot of heteronormative social conditioning that went into that. There were a lot of 1980s rom-coms that had their part to play in how I imagined my future would be. And also the family structure I came from was a very conventional one, two kids, two parents. And I just thought that that would be my life too. Mm-hmm. And then it got to the stage where I got married the first time and we started trying. And I had been fed this narrative as a teenage girl that the most important thing for me was to avoid getting pregnant at all costs. I mean, I ended up going to an all-girls school, which was very much about all of the opportunities that we had available and that our career was very important and we mustn't do something silly like getting pregnant as a teenager, all of which is good advice, I yeah. guess. But we weren't given the opposite narrative at all about how difficult it can be to get pregnant. There was nothing about fertility on the national curriculum. And so when I came off contraception when I got married, there was part of me that thought, and now it's just going to be a breeze and I'm going to fall off a log and get pregnant. And that didn't happen. And that started a series of investigations. And basically, all of the investigations came back with a big fat nothing and said, you've got unexplained infertility, which is very difficult to handle because there's no hook that you can hang
yeah.
your your focus on. And so that was part of the obsession, really, was that I had been someone who worked very hard through my life, who did the right things, who was a quote unquote good girl, who felt that if I found out the problem and I applied myself sufficiently, I would eventually come to a solution. And fertility was probably the first thing that I experienced where that approach did not work at all. And in fact, the more that I tried to apply myself, the less it seemed to work and the more intangible it became. And that feeds into this yearning that is so impossible to escape, alongside which my peers, so many of them seem to have babies without any issue whatsoever. So I'm living through this baby-geddon. I'm surrounded by people who seem to be incredibly fertile. So that feeds into the obsession. And then the hormones feed into it as well. So I was doing IVF, and the hormones, I mean, they're just a very strange thing to experience, because your feelings and emotions don't feel like your own. You feel slightly different. And so then that feeds into it as well. And then you have the kind of medical professionals saying, okay, we're just going to try this time. We're going to try one more round of this, and we're going to try altering your dosage. And so you sort of keep going and keep going, thinking next time we'll have knocked down all of the skittles that were in the way and we'll finally score a strike. And so
it sounds so grueling and so hard, Elizabeth.
Yes, it was. And actually, it's one of those things that I've only understood in retrospect, in hindsight, how hard it was. A bit like, I mean, I don't want to trivialise either experience, but growing up in the north of Ireland during the Troubles, that's taken me a very long time to process. Yeah. And I know that I'm not alone, because I speak to my peers about it. And in the same way, sometimes you're just, when you're going through fertility treatment, you're just dealing with the day-to-day, and you're just in this process and the system, you're getting through it. So it's only looking back that I realised those 12 years of my life were really, really tough. And Brendan, one of the things that I've notice now, because I'm on the other side of it, is that I spent every single day of those 12 years on the brink of tears. You could say something to me that would be completely unrelated, and I would cry unstoppably, and I felt really out of control of that. That's the best way I can try and explain it.
So it dominates your whole life, it dominates your relationships, it dominates everything, does it?
Yes, and actually, the scary thing is that you don't realise, my experience was, I didn't realise that it was dominating everything. Yeah. And so to begin with, I tried to compartmentalise it. So I didn't tell anyone at work. I didn't tell work. And I did a lot of it on my own. And that felt even more isolating. And my first marriage didn't survive it. And that wasn't the only reason. And in a way, I'm grateful for that catalyst, because it revealed things that were dysfunctional in the relationship. But it's why I'm extremely grateful now. I got remarried, and my husband now, the relationship we have is founded on communication. And I'm so grateful that I have that, because I think sometimes fertility treatment and recurrent miscarriage, both of which I experienced, can feel so isolating. And it's a bit like that shame you were describing earlier. You feel that you're uniquely ill-equipped to deal with it, and everyone else seems to be dealing with life better.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And when and why did you decide to stop trying then?
So I got to the stage where lockdown was a tricky time for, I mean, everyone. But it was very tricky if you were going through fertility treatment, because suddenly everything got put on pause that wasn't medically urgent and necessary. And I had a miscarriage right at the beginning of lockdown after a medical procedure. And that was really, really tough, because I basically was sent home with pills, and it was unbelievably painful emotionally and physically. And after that, I just wanted to give my body a rest. I just couldn't face trying again. And that's what happened. And time passed and lockdowns were lifted and then re-implemented. And I got older. And then by the time that we emerged from that strange time, I just felt like I needed more intervention, and that was the medical advice. So we tried a round of egg donation, and we did it with a clinic in LA. California is at the cutting edge of much fertility treatment, and it was a clinic that was recommended to us. And just the process of finding an egg donor was immensely stressful and took a year. And so then obviously I'm a year older. And then we eventually did this egg donation round, and it's like IVF, but with someone else's egg and my husband's sperm making the embryo. And we were told everything was A++++, like top grade, amazing embryo, basically has its PhD already. All of my levels were right. Finally, it finally felt like everything was aligned.
Okay. And so you were full of hope now.
I was full of hope. I was still cautious, because the thing about fertility struggles and miscarriage is that it robs you of any sense of uncomplicated joy around this entire subject. So I was hopeful with caution, and it was, and I was stressed, I think, and just exhausted by it all. And that egg donation round didn't work. And I was informed after 10 days by the clinic over email, who'd taken my bloods, you're not pregnant, cease all medication. And it was so devastating. And it was one of the lowest points of my life. And then I went into a period of grieving that, really, and thinking through and talking with my husband. And ultimately, it felt for me as if I'd come to the end of a very long journey. And I decided to experiment with the idea of letting it go, with letting the obsession, the dream go, and see how that felt in my body. And it felt amazing. It felt so peaceful and so aligned. And if I had heard myself say this, Brendan, like 2-3 years ago, I would never have believed it. And that's why I'm so passionate about talking about it, because I want women and men who are going through this right now, who cannot imagine a fulfilled life without having their own child, that there is not only hope on the other side of it, there is so much contentment and peace. And I found so many other ways to create and to parent. And I have so much more time to explore that. And it's been a real life lesson for me. And so that's why I decided to stop. And that's also why I think it's so important for me to keep talking about.
Okay. And look, I'll just ask you, and if you don't want to talk about
it, go ahead.
Do you regret now in any way that 12 years?
No, I don't regret it.
Really?
Because I believe that it's my path, and I believe that I had to go on that journey to get here and to do what I do. And I fundamentally believe that it's part of my purpose now to spread this message, to talk about it, and to connect with people who feel lost and alone and full of sadness, because they're in those 12 years themselves now. And that's what's given my life a lot of meaning. Now, obviously, sometimes I feel like life sends you lessons repeatedly until you learn them. And sometimes I wish that I'd learned a bit more quickly.
Yeah.
But I don't regret it.
Okay. Just before we leave it, did a psychic play a part as well in your acceptance? Yes.
Yes, I deliberately left that bit out of the story in case you thought I was unhinged. Yes.
No, go on.
So actually, I have so much love for this psychic, who I've only ever spoken to once over the phone. She didn't see my face. All she had was my first name and my phone number. And she'd been recommended to me by a dear friend of mine. And it was at that lowest point in my life when I was thinking, what do I do? Do I carry on? Do I try another round? I mean, where is the end? Am I going to sacrifice my relationship if I continue pursuing this obsession? And I was so confused. And I spoke to this incredible woman. And the first thing she said to me, and, you know, I've been to psychics before here and there because I'm really interested and curious about the things that we don't understand through human logic. And I've learned that in order to trust what they're saying, it's really good not to ask any questions I decided not to give a fake name, but I did just give my name as Elizabeth. And so she didn't know anything about me. She couldn't have done. She couldn't have Googled me. She didn't have my surname. And the first thing she said to me was, well, you love words. And I've subsequently sent friends to her and she says a different thing every time.
Okay.
And I was like, yes, I do. Okay, so she spoke to me for about half an hour about my career, life, love, not mentioning children at all. And about halfway through, she said, I feel that you're grappling right now with letting go of a lifelong desire. And if that's to do with children, I want to tell you that I believe that in a past life, you were a mother of six and it almost melted you. That was the word that she used, melted. And she said, and I feel that this life has been offered to you to live on your own terms. And it might be, she's like, I don't know how old you are, but it might be that if you've ever tried fertility treatment, it hasn't worked for you or you've had miscarriages. And when she told me that, I counted the number of fertility rounds I'd had and the number of miscarriages, and it came to six. And I thought, gosh, that's so powerful. And she gave me permission in a way to let it go without okay. feeling that I was doing the wrong thing. And from that moment, I have felt at peace with it. And I kept checking in with myself thinking, oh, maybe it won't last. Maybe I'm in denial. And it's lasted 2 years. So it's 2 years almost to the day since I had that reading with that particular psychic. And I'm so grateful to her because she really has made me be able to live alongside something that will always cause me sadness, but I feel completely at peace with it.
Extraordinary. She was worth the money.
She was.
Okay. Dating. You recently did a podcast series about dating, how to date. How did you find dating at different stages of life?
Well, I didn't really date for any of my life until I reached 36. And the reason was, from the age of 19 to 36, I was in a series of basically back-to-back long-term monogamous relationships, which culminated in a failed marriage. And the reason I had so many of those long-term relationships is because I was scared, I think, of what I'd find if I was on my own. And I devoted myself to being an extreme people pleaser and okay. just trying to contort myself into the shape of whatever my partner at any given time would want. And spoiler alert, that's not a healthy foundation for a relationship.
Good God, so, like what you have put yourself through. I'm amazed you're not just exhausted and taken to the bed for the rest of your life.
I do love bed, to be fair. And this is what I mean about learning lessons more quickly. Anyway, so I got to my late 30s, and that's the first time I dated, which is not a great time for a straight woman, age-wise, to start dating.
Okay. And a lot of weirdos out there, is there?
Yes, but it's not just that. Like, I was also the weirdo. It's like...
Yeah, okay.
It's also that in a numbers game. So men on dating apps... Straight men on dating apps, the statistics show this, they get their pick basically. And there's a lot of women who feel their biological clock is ticking and who get to the point where they really, really want a relationship so they can have a baby. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it just means that there's this sense of, it's almost like it's sort of desperation. And I'm not saying the woman is desperate, but there's like a desperation to sort things out in your life. And I was no different. And so it meant that I went into dating too quickly without having spent time on myself yeah. to work out who I was, to date myself in a way and to work out who I was and what I thought about myself and what kind of relationship I wanted. I just wanted to get out there. And so, yeah, I had some nightmare dates and some hilarious stories, and it taught me a lot about dealing with rejection, and it taught me a lot about rejection being the result of someone else's emotional journey and not necessarily predicated on who I am as a person, and that was helpful.
There's absolutely no way they were rejecting you. You're fantastic. You did meet your current husband on a dating app then?
I did. So it was all worth it in the end. But honestly, I got to the point where I'd lost quite a bit of hope.
Really?
But someone had told me about this new app called Hinge, and I downloaded it one Saturday morning, and Justin was the first person I matched with and the only person I went on a date with from that app. But because my expectations were so low, they were practically on the floor. And I think actually,
this guy couldn't lose, could he?
This kid couldn't lose, and that's the secret to happiness, is like having moderate expectations. And he'd put not very good photos on his profile. And I basically just thought, I'll get this date out of the way. And I actually booked flights to go and move to LA full time. I did it that morning. I was like, this Thursday evening, I've got this date, I'll get it out of the way. And I walked into this hotel bar and there's this very handsome man. And he was the only person I'd ever met who put less flattering photos of himself online than he looked in person, because he's not vain. And I was like, oh, he's actually a decent, handsome man. And I was so flustered that the first thing I did after sitting down was fall off my bar stool, which was the most embarrassing moment of my life. But I think what happened was it meant that I just wasn't pretending anymore. There was no way I could pretend to be cool after that. And so it was a sort of shortcut to connection. And I'm so grateful to Justin for taking a chance on me despite my clumsiness.
Okay, so I'm making a list here. So psychics and Hinge is what you're saying,
yes,
to people is the answer.
Well,
tonight.
Well, no, I'm not saying that.
Know,
Hinge apparently is not great anymore.
It's a whole new dynamic. So listen, it is kind of noted that for somebody who's known for kind of how to fail, you're now, you know, very successful. And like, on paper, you seem to me to have a fabulous life, like down to your fashion sense. Can I say, even as a man, I envy your style. Absolutely.
Oh, that's such a compliment. But, thank you.
But the question is this. Does success and a fabulous life on paper and all that, does it cure all the neuroses and the pain the way we imagine it might?
Oh, no.
No,
not in the way that you not in the way that you imagine from afar, but it does make it easier to live with them. So what I mean by that is, doing all this work on failure has really radically redefined what I think of as success. And success now for me, it's not about money or clothes. So that's really, really nice, don't get me wrong. And I'd like to say it's not necessarily about external validation, but that's still a process for me, because I actually really appreciate it. But success for me now is being able to drop the mask, to drop the pretense that I think I lived with during my 20s and some of my 30s. It's to be able to show up as myself, all the flaws, all the imperfections there, and to be authentic and aligned with that, and to be a whole person, and to bring that person into every situation. So talking to you now, I'm the same me as I am when I write my books, when I'm at home with my husband, when I'm on the podcast. There's that. It's just such a relief to live in that alignment.
Amazing. Yeah.
And so that's what helps. That's what helps with all the neuroses, is that I don't feel I'm hiding anything. And neuroses, like shame, they hide and they thrive in silence. And so actually, if I could encourage anyone listening to this to be kinder to themselves and to take the risk of vulnerability, of opening up, of sharing just to one person, I just think it makes you feel much more yourself. And it's actually an act of generosity to the other person too, who feels closer to you and who can connect with you. And that's why these live shows with How to Fail are so special, and why I'm so thrilled to be coming to Dublin on April the 6th.
And beautiful, because I was just going to ask you, so you will host a live episode. I mean, look, you're good.
You were
gently getting me back there. No, you think I've given you enough now, boy. So a live episode of How to Fail at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre on April 6th. And your special guest is Emma Dabbery. So what can people expect on the night?
Well, I'm so happy that Emma is the guest, because I've met her before and she's interviewed me. And then we just could not stop chatting afterwards. We got the train back from the event together. And she's had such a fascinating life.
Yeah.
And she is such a smart, powerful woman. So the first half of our evening will be me interviewing her exactly as I do on the podcast in front of a live studio audience. We'll talk through her three failures, which I've seen, by the way, and they're amazing. And it will lead us into some really deep, moving, but also funny and inclusive territory. So that's the first half, which is about 45 minutes. Then there's an interval for you all to grab your drinks at the bar. And then we come back and we have an audience Q&A where you can ask Emma or myself anything that crosses your mind. And so that's the format of the evening, and then we go and have a Guinness at the pub, and that's it.
Job done. What a night out. Okay, so that's Elizabeth Day, How to Fail at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre on April 6th. For tickets and more information, people can go to bgetheatre.ie. Elizabeth Day, can I thank you so much for your openness, your generosity, your honesty? But clearly that's how you roll these days. I think it was Jung who said that, like, what we're all aiming for is integration, isn't it, of our shadow selves and the public face we put on. You've done it. You've hit enlightenment. You are a completely authentic person and it's fantastic to behold. Thanks.
Brendan, I just want to say Jung is my favourite philosopher. So it's just so funny that you've quoted him, because that's exactly how I strive to live my life.
Listen, you and me clearly knew each other in that previous life when you were a harried mother of six.
Maybe you were one of my six children. I'm kidding.
Maybe I was. Okay, Mum. Elizabeth Day, right, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye, thanks.